Good evening, folks. This is The Weird Part, and I am your host, Vincent Treewell. Thank you for joining me. Tonight, I will be doing a little bit of updates, but then I want to get into the real meat of the program, which is going to be a public response to Professor Robert Sapolsky. This issue first came up when I was a guest on Sarai Asketh's excellent show, Where Did the Road Go? And he and I and Saxon talked about a new book that has come out by neurobiologist Robert Sapolsky, who argues against free will in a book titled Determined, A Life of Science Without Free Will. And he makes a number of interesting arguments that free will does not exist and all human actions are determined by genetics, biochemistry, life experience, and conditions going on at the moment, that there is no such thing as free will. Now, I'm not going to debate Dr. Sapolsky. He said he's not doing debates anyway, so that's neither here nor there. I'm not even going to take issue with his beliefs, which I strongly disagree with. I believe free will is the essence of being a human, of being a sentient being, is having free will. I believe that while we are limited by our circumstances of what we can accomplish, what we can do, that's different than saying you don't have a choice. I feel you always have a choice. That's my opinion. That's not really what I'm here to talk about. The reason I wouldn't, if I could, debate Professor Sapolsky, is he is a neurobiologist. He knows a lot about neurology, biochemistry, all that type of thing. Now, this is a debate that is in no way new. And scientifically, it's been going on for over a century. And philosophically, it's been going on for basically ever. It is my opinion, which I am not, this is also not the topic of the show, that is his scientific materialist reductionist version of determinism is simply a secular version of Calvinism, which is the doctrine of the Presbyterian Church founded by John Calvin, who preached that some people are chosen to be saved and everybody else goes to hell. And yeah, that's just, God already decided that way before you were born, and it's just what it is. That's a very nutshell version of Calvinism, and I wouldn't defend that without making a whole show on it, which I'm not going to do because I don't care that much. But anyway, my problem with Sapolsky isn't with his data or with his, if he just believes there's no such thing as free will, well, that's fine. My problem with him is that he has this belief that if everybody gave up believing in free will, we'd have a more just and more free society. And I am not a scientist, but I am a lawyer. And I can tell you, and a former law officer, and I can tell you that that's not what would happen. And I want to go kind of deep on this, on what would really happen if we as a society, or any society, accepted that there is no such thing as free will, and people are just determined by their genetics, biochemistry, and life circumstances to do the things they do. And it would be not a utopia, it would be a dystopia. It would be an absolute nightmare of wrongful incarceration, of penalties for people who've done nothing, and we'll get there. But it wouldn't be a more free and more fair society. It would be a much less free and much more unjust society. And I believe I can prove that. We'll get there. I would like to give a couple of updates before I really get into the meat of the show. And that is, I just came back. Okay, it's Wednesday the 8th when I'm saying this, but I came back on Monday the 6th from the Strange Realities Conference in Nashville, Tennessee, hosted by Conspiranormal hosts, Adam Sane and Sir Fael Stevenson. Absolutely wonderful time. Absolutely awesome speakers. I can't praise it highly enough. One of these days, I'm going to be on that stage, okay? But anyway, met and reconnected with so many people that I have a great rapport with, and that we really vibe, and it was a great time. And anybody who ever gets a chance to go to Strange Realities should definitely do that. And if you can, you should go in person. Now, the virtual... presentations. That's why I almost said performances, but they're presentations. Were excellent. Of course they were. But when you also get to meet those people and hang out with them and talk off the record, and it's the difference between watching the Tonight Show and being in the audience for the Tonight Show, and then Jimmy Fallon and Questlove ask you if you want to hang out with them after the show. Yeah, it's like that. It's really cool. And so had a great time, learned a lot of stuff, networked with a bunch of people, many of whom are going to show up on here in the very near future. And excellent. Just two thumbs up. Anyway, that's where I spent from Friday to Monday. And I'm back, and we're back on the weird part. And we're going to, I think we're going to have a pretty damn good solo show tonight, if I may say so. As usual, it probably won't be as long as when I have a guest, but I think it'll be longer than the average. So we're going to start up in just a moment. Oh, well, let's get serious. We're talking about Dr. Robert Sapolsky, who recently published a book called Determined, A Life of Science Without Free Will. And again, as I mentioned, he is a PhD-level neurobiologist. He has spent much of his life studying baboons in the wild. Spends about half of the year doing that. I'll just let that... That's a fact, okay? Just set that aside and consider. I'm not going to debate with any of Dr. Sapolsky's expertise or his data. The data is not anything mind-blowingly new. This topic has been around, even in its current form, for decades. And he brings some very interesting information. But it can all be read different ways. And it really is a matter of interpretation. What bothers me isn't that, and for those interested, and I strongly encourage this, I read an article about this on the Daily Grail, and shout out to the Daily Grail and to Red Pill Junkie and everybody involved with that, because great source for finding weird news. They linked to a website from John Horgan, which is John with an H, H-O-R-G-A-N, Horgan. In parentheses, the science writer. And he goes into the scientific angle on Sapolsky's work and what he has proved or hasn't proved. And John Horgan is a science writer. I'm not. But I am an attorney. I used to be a cop. So bear that in mind, okay? This is the angle I'm coming at. What bothers me isn't that this guy believes that there's no free will and he can prove it. Again, that's a long-term debate that's been going on. I don't care about that. Okay, somebody believes something, then fine. What irks me, and why I'm doing like a podcast devoted to this, is his rather casual assumption that if we all stop being judgmental and just agreed that there's no free will and people don't have any choice and everybody's basically programmed to do what they do, even the worst things, that would lead to a more just and free society. As John Horgan says in his article about Sapolsky, far from being a jerk, Sapolsky is a compassionate social justice warrior. He argues persuasively, movingly, now this is John Horgan's words, not mine, that luck is the primary difference between white male professors and, say, people in prison. We need to change the world, he says, so good luck is distributed more fairly. When people do bad things, we need to be more forgiving. We're more likely to achieve these goals, Sapolsky contends, if we stop believing in free will. But there's another twist to the Sapolsky paradox. In the just, gentle world that Sapolsky envisions, and I'll just break it off there because that's the thing. He is long on data involving neurology and biochemistry, and to some degree, the effects of poverty and things like that. But he's really short on what would be the consequences if it became the consensus opinion that there is no free will and that you can't make a choice, that you are programmed to by your environment and by your genetics and by your biochemistry to do whatever it is you've done. He seems to think that then we just let everybody who's committed a crime go and empty the prisons and that everything would be more forgiving and it'd be fine. And no, that's not, he seems, maybe for a guy who spends a good chunk of the year studying the baboons, he may not have a tight grip on the legal and political situation in the United States and in essentially every other country in the world, mostly. He doesn't seem to get that we already have a system for dealing with people who don't have free will. And that is through involuntary commitment. In his world, if everybody accepted that nobody has a choice, you just program to do what you're going to do, do you really think that we would let the serial killers, the sexual predators, the terrorists, domestic and imported, the people who, the school shooters, the people who've done horrible things, we just let them walk free? That seems like what he's saying. And, you know, that's a very amusing sort of anarchism, but that is not what would happen. He doesn't seem aware that we already have a system for dealing with people that don't have a choice, that don't have free will, and that would be the involuntary commitments system, which is for those who are deemed mentally ill or not guilty of a crime due to mental disease or defect. And that's a lot of people. Now, if you've committed a crime and then are found to be insane, you're put in a certain system. Also, in that same system are people who have not committed a crime, but who have made statements or done actions that indicate that they are too mentally ill to run their own lives, and they pose a danger to themselves and others. Those are keywords, danger to yourself and others. Well, if everybody agreed with Professor Sapolsky, the prisons might be empty, but the maximum security mental hospitals would be chock full, and we'd have to build a bunch more, and we would. Okay, a lot of this goes back to the McNaughton rule, and this is a key part of Anglo-American, when I say Anglo-American, I mean the legal system of Britain and the United States and Australia and Canada and South Africa and all of the British Commonwealth, which come from the source of mostly with reforms such as the U.S. Constitution, but come from British their system of government. And the Macnaughton rule was formulated as a reaction to the acquittal in 1843 of Daniel Macnaughton on the charge of murdering Edward Drummond. I'm getting this from the greatest source of all, Wikipedia, but I vouched for it on several other places. Plus, we talked this to death in law school, so it is what it is. This is correct. The Macnaughton rule. Formulated to the reaction to the acquittal in 1843 of Daniel Macnaughton on the charge of murdering Edward Drummond. Macnaughton had shot Drummond after mistakenly identifying him as the British Prime Minister Robert Peel, who was the intended target. The House of Lords asked a panel of judges, presided over by Sir Nicholas Cunningham, Tyndall, Chief Justice of the Common Pleas, a series of hypothetical questions about the defense of insanity. The principles expounded by this panel have come to be known as the Macnaughton Rules, though they have gained any status only by the usage in the common law, and Macnaughton himself would have been found guilty if they had been applied at his trial. The rules so formulated as Macnaughton Case 1843 have been a standard test for criminal liability in relation to mentally disordered defendants in common law jurisdictions ever since, with some minor adjustments. When the tests set out by the rules are satisfied, the accused may be adjudged not guilty by reason of insanity or guilty but insane, and the sentence may be a mandatory or discretionary, but usually indeterminate, period of treatment in a secure hospital facility, or otherwise at the discretion of the court. And it goes on to say the insanity defense is recognized in Australia, Canada, England, Hong Kong, India, Republic of Ireland, New Zealand, Norway, and most U.S. states, with the exception of Idaho, Kansas, Montana, Utah, and Vermont. Not all of these jurisdictions still use the Macnaughton rules. States that disallow the insanity defense still allow defendants to demonstrate they are not capable of forming intent to commit a crime as a result of mental illness. Now, without turning this into a legal continuing education class, take that and put that next to what Dr. Sapolsky is talking about. There are people in our society who don't have free will because they are so mentally ill that they cannot make rational decisions. They don't necessarily perceive the world as everyone else does, and they may not be able to, and there are definitely people like that. That is a real thing. Insanity is real. And those people can be put away in a secure facility, locked up, without having committed a crime. There's, again, as I said, there's two sides of it. There are people who are not guilty by reason of insanity. They don't go home. I don't know if Professor Sapolsky doesn't understand this, or if he's just not taking it into account, but people who commit a crime and are found to have not had the ability to have intent, who are found to be suffering from a mental illness that does not allow them to have free will, those people don't go home. They go to a mental hospital, which can be more restrictive than a prison. I have been to a place, that the Wisconsin Resource Center that we have in Wisconsin, that has people who are found not guilty by reason of insanity. And depending on the nature of your illness, wow, it made the jail look like a public park. I mean, it was really restrictive for some people. Okay. The idea would just be peace and freedom if we stop believing in free will ignores that we already have a system, an elaborate system. In fact, several systems for dealing with people who don't have free will. Because what I just mentioned is part of the prison system. That's for those who have been found to have committed a crime, but be very mentally ill. There's also Sand Hill, a facility for sexual predators, where someone has served all of their sentence, but is still found to be a danger to society because they cannot control their urges And so they're kept locked up in a very prison-like setting, in though they've committed no new crime. They're not serving a sentence. They're being held because they're a danger to society. And there's a third category of people who have not committed a crime, but who have, by their words or actions, demonstrated that they are not, they don't have free will. They're not capable of making rational decisions. And they're locked up in mental health facilities. That process is called Chapter 51 in Wisconsin. Okay. But basically, every state has something like it, where a person can be locked up. Now they have to, it's civil commitment. And there is a trial. They get an attorney. I have been the attorney in some of these, okay? Because every year, if they're held involuntarily, every year they get a chance to appeal. And I've handled some of those appeals. I wish I could say I'd won one, but no. Now, usually there are people that legitimately have serious problems. But they don't go home. They don't just get released into the world to do whatever they want. They're contained. And a lot of them are, some are in group homes, which they have varying levels of freedom. Others are in real locked ward, what used to be called asylums, okay? And I am not making any allegations of abuse. That's not what I'm saying. But I am saying that it sure as hell not freedom, okay? It is certainly not going to confuse that with being a free person. Absolutely not. So the idea that if we all just accepted that nobody can control our actions, that everything would be fine, everybody would be free to go, is the most absurd thing I've heard in a long time, okay? I don't debate flat earthers, but it's like one step from that, okay, in my humble opinion, okay? We already have multiple systems for dealing with people who don't have free will. Now, if we accepted that nobody has free will, the consequences of that would be disastrous, because we're not going, we as a society, I don't mean you, but as a society, we're not going to allow people that are considered dangerous, who obviously can't control their actions, because nobody can control their actions, to wander the streets and do what they will. It's not going to happen. Instead, many millions of people would be involuntarily incarcerated in one form or another. And, you know, that to me is screamingly obvious. And this has been addressed in fiction on numerous occasions, but particularly two spring to mind is really important. One is a concept of pre-crime that was developed by Philip K. Dick, the absolutely wonderful novelist, whose work has been made into numerous movies. But in this case, The Minority Report, which, yeah, there's a movie available. I haven't seen it because it stars Tom Cruise, but that's neither here nor there. I have read the novel. It's excellent. And Philip K. Dick came up with the concept of pre-crime, that in the future, we would be able to predict who's going to do what. And I won't try to go through the plot of The Minority Report. But everyone read it. If you care to watch movies like that, watch them. I'm trying not to step too hard, but you know what I'm saying. Anyway, it's probably a movie worth seeing, to be very honest. But yeah, Philip K. Dick's The Minority Report predicted what would happen in a world where the government and society felt that they could know what people are going to do before they do it. And people are arrested for crimes that they're going to commit when they haven't actually taken one step to do anything like that. Well, Dr. Robert Sapolsky, what do you think would happen if society as a group, if the consensus reality was that we don't have free will and nobody can control the decisions? A whole hell of a lot of people would be locked up involuntarily. That's what would happen. And I base that on, what are the criteria? Well, Dr. Sapolsky, what determines our behavior? Genetics. Oh, there's a loaded one. So I assume the people who are deciding who's dangerous and who's not would have no biases or prejudices. I hope it's those people. And as soon as I meet a person like that, I'll let you know, because I never have. Okay. The idea that genetics would be a key component is incredibly dangerous. That's what eugenics, we already did that in America. The eugenics movement was mainstream 100 years ago. The idea that people's lineage determined what their behavior would be like was common pretty much until World War II and the Holocaust, and the aftermath of that, we saw what eugenics is like when Hitler really carried out in real life. Okay, that's what eugenics leads to. But in America, we didn't go quite that far exactly, but eugenics was a supporting pillar for so many bad things, for all sorts of pseudo-scientifically backed racism, and led to so many bad things. It was a justification for segregation. It was a justification for the atrocities committed against Native Americans. And it was a justification for sterilizing a lot of poor people. It was a justification for everything. Basically, everything that was justified by it was very bad. Okay? Well, if you take away free will and you say genetics is a key component, you're resurrecting eugenics, even if that's not your intention, which I know it's not. I know that Sapolsky is not a racist. He's not a fascist. He's quite the opposite. He's a very, pardon my use of the term hippie, but that's kind of, he's a hippie style, essentially anarchist. But that's not what would be the result. The result would be the resurrection of eugenics. Okay? Once you say people are genetically programmed, you open this huge door to pseudoscientifically justified racism. That's what happens. And then look at the other criteria. Biochemistry. Well, I don't know, do you give somebody a blood test? Determine that they have the wrong hormones or the wrong constitution to make good decisions? Maybe they have too much testosterone, so that leads to them being incarcerated for the protection of everyone else. Does that make any sense? Hey, pardon me, but you should have to do something before you get locked up. I believe that, okay? But I also strongly believe in free will. And then, while he means it in the best possible way, I don't think Dr. Sapolsky's in contact with the political realities of this country. But if you say environment and social conditions determine what a person is going to do, what do you think that would lead to? Do you think that would really lead to a more equitable society, where we basically embrace a form of socialism and everybody has, you know, equal wealth? Has that ever happened in America? Okay. Is that on the horizon? No. What it would lead to is mass incarceration of poor people for being poor. Some would argue that we already have that, but at least there's the formality of having to go through the legal system. To get locked up in America, you have to do something. In Sapolsky's future, and his unintended consequences, I don't mean for a second that he wants this to happen. He just hasn't thought through. If we all agreed that behavior is chemically, genetically, and socially determined, it wouldn't be freedom and peace. It would be mass incarceration of the poor for being poor. It would be mass incarceration of people with the wrong genetics. It would be mass incarceration of people who've done nothing. But the government feels they know what you're going to do before you do it. So we'll just put you in prison, which we won't call prison. We'll call it a treatment facility, but you're really never getting out. So yeah, that's what would really happen. We already have the infrastructure to do that. So, you know, that's why I'm doing this podcast. Because Sapolsky really set me off with that. That you think it would lead to a more just and fair and free society. It would lead to the opposite. And having covered Philip K. Dick's concept of pre-crime, before that, there was the, you know, this is a classic work, 1984 by George Orwell, where he uses the word thought crime to describe a person's politically unorthodox thoughts, beliefs, and doubts that politically contradict the tenets of the dominant ideology. Yeah, that's what this would also lead to. That if we can't show that you're genetically predisposed, we can't show you're chemically predisposed, we can't show that you've committed the crime of being born into a poor family, then anything you say could be used to find you dangerous. And therefore, you're because you have no free will, you're going to do something terrible. And therefore, we're just going to preventively detain you for probably an unlimited time. Okay? Thought crime. George Orwell. 1984. Everybody's watched. Well, in our society already, everybody's watched. And what you post online, what you text, what you communicate in any possible way, it's accessible by the government. One movie I would recommend watching is Snowden. Go ahead, take a gander at that, and just consider how it influences you, because it influenced me. You know, I can't live a silent, hide in the basement life, but it makes you want to watching that flick. Let me tell you. And that's what the government could already do like a decade ago, okay? Or more, you know. They can watch you. They do watch you. Now, if we had a world where they didn't have to prove any acts, they didn't have to prove any planning to do something bad, just that you fit a certain profile, that you have said something that means something, how many people would be locked up preventatively? And that, you know, is what a mass acceptance of the lack of free will would lead to. Because you could be psychologically profiled. The FBI used to do a lot of that. It later turned out that a lot of that was not scientifically based. And that really, that rarely led to any actual convictions, because it suggested the type of person, somebody like this committed this crime, but there's always a bunch of people like that, and there's not a solid suspect with evidence that actually proves this happened. And that in a future where everyone accepted Sapolsky's ideas, well, the police wouldn't need evidence that you actually did anything, just that you're the kind of person who would do something like that. Well, that's a hell of a lot lower bar, you know? Now, I could go on for another hour about why I believe in free will, but I'm not interested in that so much as in Sapolsky's incredibly wrong-headed ideas of what the mass acceptance of there is no free will would mean for our society, because it would be a disaster. And I just, you know, without getting too far into the legalese, we already have multiple systems for people who are acknowledged to not have free will. Between those found to be not guilty by reason of insanity, those found to be guilty but incapable of participating in their defense because they are mentally ill, and between the involuntary commitment, we already have a whole trident of ways of dealing with people who don't have free will. If we agree that nobody had free will, we as a group, as a country, as a world, agreed that nobody has free will, there would be mass incarceration of people who have done nothing. And that, to me, is sure as hell not a utopia. It's about as bad as it gets. It's a dystopia. So that's what I have to say for tonight. Sapolsky's wrong in so many ways, and we do have free will, but the idea that if everyone accepted we don't have free will, it would lead to anything good is completely wrong, and it would instead be a disaster, and it would be the absence of freedom and the absence of justice. So, on that note, I think I've made my point, and I hope that you've enjoyed hearing this, and feel free to respond. I'm at VincentTreewell@gmail.com, and thank you for listening, and good night.